As a church, we've just finished a series on the 9 core practices that comprise the Bridgetown Rule of Life. And as we continue to integrate it into the shared life of our church, we wanted to provide a resource to help explore what a rule of life actually is and how we came about integrating one into our context at Bridgetown Church. So we've created a 4-part podcast that will expound on these 2 questions, providing a helpful account of where we've been and how we hope that a shared rule of life will direct where we are headed. As we often say around here, we believe the future of the church is ancient. If we desire to move forward in our identity and calling as a unified community, we need to do so having the robust foundation of a rich life with God built out of shared practice. We believe these conversations will be a helpful resource to you as you consider what a rule of life looks like in your context, and we hope you will join us for this journey as we seek to be made into God's image together. Friends, if you've been along this journey with us so far, you know that Tyler and I are having a series of conversations with people around the world who are experts in some realm or area of rule of life, or just well-versed in their own experience of it. And it's been such a journey so far. We've been having such a good time. And so our final conversation right now is going to be with Sister Heather Christine, who is a spiritual director and avowed member of the Order of the Common Life, which is a Protestant monastic order. And she is really wonderful. She's got extensive experience serving and doing spiritual direction with folks who are recovering from all kinds of addictions, including survivors of trafficking, and then also with people who are working with these folks. And so she's really deeply committed to this idea of a rule of life, working itself out in the average and the ordinary and the often kind of chaotic world around us. So Sister Heather, thank you for being with us today. We are very, very excited for our conversation.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks, Kevin.
So let's go ahead and kind of jump in here to this first question. Why a shared rule of life? There's so much kind of in our world that's about self-improvement or self-betterment. So how is a rule of life actually different from that? How is it not just project self, or is it? And what about a shared rule of life specifically? How does the Spirit kind of use a rule of life to actually transform someone?
Great question. I think a rule of life could end up just being a program of self-improvement, depending on what the motivation and intention is behind it. I think we always come to things with a mix of motivations. Some are healthy and, you know, rightly ordered motivations, and others maybe not so much. And you don't have to have all pure motivations, but you do have to have enough of those to really sustain anything that you're trying to do over the long term. But a rule of life, if it is geared towards freeing you up and bringing healing and formation in your life so that you can move in God's call on your life and do the things that He is creating you to do, then I think it's different than if you're just trying to be a stronger, faster, more productive person.
Yeah. And I'm wondering too, even as you're saying that, you're a spiritual director who meets with people, a number of people around a shared rule of life. So like, as you're doing that, is a shared rule of life something you like convince someone to do? Or is there like need for desire at some level to be there first?
I think the most important invitation would just be to grow deeper in one's relationship with God. I think, especially the people I work with, the tendency is to craft this really elaborate rule of life. And we're always pushing back against that and encouraging simplicity and starting small and really not running ahead of where the Spirit is leading. Like, God's not going to try and form you all at once. Usually there's a particular area of a rule of life for a season that God will invite someone deeper into. So I would say it's actually more important to get really good at listening for those invitations and responding to those invitations rather than trying to run ahead and craft this elaborate rule of life that's, you know, really just a giant to-do list of practices.
Yeah, I think what I hear you saying, Sister Heather, is that maybe the general practice of a rule of life defined as these are the Spirit's invitations to me at this time, and I'm embodying those invitations or living into them through these this various set of practices. That is not something that someone needs a particular lightning strike moment of clarity from God to engage. That's sort of the whole of apprenticeship to Jesus. But maybe what an individual's rule of life looks like should be a direct response to the thematic work of the Spirit in any given season. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, that's very good. Yeah. When I'm helping people, particularly in their monastic formation as part of our order, I'm helping them answer three questions. Who is God creating them to be? What is God calling them to do? And what is the way of life that would best nurture and support their pursuit of those, the answers to those first two questions? And so a rule of life really fits in this third category. It's a means to an end. It's not an end in and of itself. So what I love about the Bridgetown rule of life is each of these items start with the formational work. And in my practice, I actually have to constantly redirect people to that formational work. People tend to focus on the practices themselves, but what's really important is what the formational work that practice is doing, because different practices will form people differently depending on what their needs are, what their disposition is, what the inner work or healing that God is doing in that season. And so kind of a flexibility, a playfulness, an attitude of experimentation, and generosity and compassion for oneself, I think is really helpful, especially in the beginning stages, because your journey doesn't need to look like anybody else's. I've seen over and over and over again, God show up so personally and creatively in each person's life, and really tailoring those invitations to the specific work that God is doing in each person.
Gavin, do you mind if I slow our roll for just a second to get some definitions out of Sister Heather?
But please, by all means.
You just dropped two terms that I think I might know what you mean, but I wonder if the Bridgetown family listening to this will. So first, you referenced a part of our order. Tell me about that. What is the order that you are a part of? What do you mean by that?
Yes, so I'm a vowed member of the Order of the Common Life, which is a Protestant missional monastic order, and our goal is to form people in the love of God, to notice and nurture the work of the love of God in their lives, in the lives of the people around them, and out into the world.
Beautiful. And you said monastic formation. So when you say monastic formation, what do you mean? Is that different than, I don't know, what I might define as ordinary spiritual formation, or having a daily time of reading and praying, or, you know, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I don't think it's actually very different at all. It's just the language I'm used to using in my world.
So, but I do think it would be fair to say that preserved within the various monastic streams of church history, there might be more an emphasis on what's often called aesthetic practices than we commonly see in the Protestant church today, or the evangelical church in the modern West today, where, and when I say aesthetic practices, I'm talking about way embodied practices where God is making his appeal to us in a way that maybe doesn't start with the intellect, but starts somewhere else, starts with our stomach or starts with our desire or just some other entry point into the formation of our whole person. Hmm. Would you agree with that? Or have any light to shed on that, the necessity of monastic practice in the Christian life?
Hmm. You know what's interesting is that when I tell people that I'm part of a religious order and they ask me to say more about that, the most common thing I hear is, aren't all Christians called to that? Hmm. Isn't this how we're all supposed to live?
It's good. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Absolutely.
Hmm. It's good. So let me actually take this then, because so far we've talked a lot about like the significance and the beauty of desire and kind of these almost like cultivating the work that the Spirit is doing in me through something that like I resonate with. So I'm curious about, in your experience, you and I specifically have had many conversations about this idea of resistance and how resistance is to be, is used to reveal things in us. And so when it comes to this idea of a shared rule of life, how do you differentiate the kind of resistance that's actually healthy and like worth pushing into and pushing past and pushing through and will form something, and the kind of resistance that actually will, I don't know, like malform or deform our spiritual journey? And it actually, that kind of resistance actually needs to be heeded and listened to.
Yeah, I think it's really important that people develop really good self-awareness and honesty with themselves first, because if you're going to explore your experience of resistance in some of these practices, it could be very easy to just, you know, suppress that feeling of resistance and, or try and avoid it, or just assume that this is supposed to be hard and not listen to why it's hard. Because the goal isn't just to do the practice, even if you don't feel like doing it. I mean, that, you know, builds some obedience and strengthens that muscle, that, you know, willingness. Yes, but you're resistant to it for a reason. And so being able to pay attention to where that resistance is coming from is very important, because otherwise there might be something there that needs to be heeded. There might be a misalignment of motivations that needs to be explored. You might be, you know, wanting to have I think of like habit trackers and how you don't want to break the chain. You want to make sure you do the habit every single day. But if the choice comes down to observing one of your practices or caring for a friend in need that day, like, you know, which one are you going to choose? Is it more important that you, you know, check something off your to-do list or respond in love to the person in front of you? And so the formational work is forming us to love as God loves. The practices aren't necessarily the most important thing. It is the inner work. And so if you're resistant to doing something, you know, explore why you're experiencing the resistance. I get really excited when my directees are experiencing resistance, because that is where I see God do some of the deepest work. And it means something is happening. Something is being stirred up. Something is being brought to the surface.
Can you give me, like, I'm along with the other demographics that you work with a lot of pastors and ministers, and some of whom even I'm imagining have experienced some level of burnout, and leaders who are feeling just overwhelmed and like they just can't keep going. What do you talk to them about with resistance? What do you think that the role that resistance plays in their experience?
Wow, so many different stories are popping into my head right now. You know, I don't just work with pastors. I work with a lot of people that are on the front lines in like really intense, heartbreaking ministries. And I think there can be this idea that it's all on that person to save people. that if they don't do it, this person will be lost, this person will die. And so they're holding their ministry in an unsustainable way, and they're trusting in themselves and not in not trusting in God to do that work. And so when they're experiencing resistance, you know, it goes back to those motivations I was talking about at the beginning of our conversation. You know, some of the ministry leaders I work with, it's easier to focus on other people's suffering than on their own. Mm-hmm. And so they burn themselves out serving other people because they don't want to look at their own stuff. Mm-hmm. And so if they're experiencing, I don't think resistance is the right word to use for that, but if they're experiencing burnout, they might think it's resistance. They might think it's just something to push through. It's supposed to be hard and I need to just keep going. They actually really need to slow down and pay attention to themselves and look at the expectations that they're putting on themselves, maybe a lack of boundaries that they have. They really need to slow down before burnout hits. And that's why I think really good self-awareness and rhythms of reflection and taking time to meet regularly with the spiritual director, those are all things that will keep people in touch with their experience in a way that will hopefully raise the alarm when they're doing something in an unsustainable way. Mm.
I like that because I like what you're saying, where resistance actually sometimes is telling the truth to us. It's not always a lie. And, you know, I think in the Protestant world, especially, we're kind of trained to believe that like our desires are always dangerous. And I know that's my experience. And so I think it's interesting to note like, hey, some of my desires, even some of my unpleasant experiences in relationship to those desires might be telling the truth. And some of them might be trying to tell me lies. And so I like each of the examples you've used, I mean, by nature of what you're doing with these individuals, but is that the difference can't be discerned alone. Like there's a nature where community has to actually be a part of this discernment about, is this resistance telling me the truth or not? And I think part of what you're getting at is like, what is it trying to uncover or cover? In that, is my resistance trying to cover up the fact that I've overextended my limits? And then I'm trying to spiritually bypass that by keeping on going? Or is my resistance actually something that is lying to me and saying, well, you actually really just should be comfortable because you've earned this. And so you should quit this thing and you should just go by yourself. And so I think it's beautiful to say that like resistance can be telling the truth and it can be lying. And we cannot decide that by ourselves, but we need to find faithful, helpful people who can help us discern what it's saying or not. Does that make sense? Does that sound like kind of some of what you're saying there?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I'm thinking back to the resistance I was experiencing in my practice of Sabbath. I was the only part-time staff member on a team of full-time people at the time. And they all had a practice of Sabbath and I did not, but what happened was my work was just kind of bleeding into every day. And so at one point I was like, I'm going to take their example and I'm going to set aside one whole day for Sabbath. And every Monday when we would get together, one of my coworkers would be like, how is your Sabbath? And for about 10 months, I said, terrible. I hated every minute of it. I'm glad it's over. I'm dreading next week.
Oh, no.
And after about 10 months, because, you know, I was faithful to keep leaning into the practice and they kept encouraging me to keep leaning into the practice and get curious about it, I noticed so many things about my attachment to productivity, my need for constant reassurance, my need to check things off my to-do list. I got present to an insecure attachment style where I would spend my Sabbath alone. So I didn't get any feedback from other people, no reassurance, no encouragement from anybody else. Wow. And realizing how dependent I was on that from other people. Hmm. And so I'm a little embarrassed to say it took me 10 months to figure that out. And then it took me another year and a half to start enjoying my Sabbath. Because then I knew, okay, this is inner work that God is doing in me, and it's uncomfortable and I don't like it and I'm resistant to it, but I know it's good and it's necessary and it's actually gonna create freedom for me in areas that I desperately need freedom in order to walk in my calling. And all along the way, my spiritual friends, the people that were on the ministry team with me were, you know, deeply encouraging. And the accountability of being asked every week how my Sabbath was kept me honest.
It's good.
You know, all this is drawing out a question for me, Sister Heather. So one unique thing is that within an order, there, you know, you're covenanting to shared practice and rule of life with others. There's an expression of rule of life pretty popularized, maybe within at least the stream of church that Bridgetown occupies these days, which is about an individual creating an individualized rule of life, which I think can be a very helpful kind of training wheels on ramp to the full expression of a rule of life, which throughout church history has always been communal. And you're within a community sharing a rule of life. We're talking about a local church sharing a rule of life in community. Why do you believe that community has always been and is currently a necessity or an important part of this practice?
Let me just sit with that for a moment, because I have so many directions I could take this.
Sure.
I'm also not sure how much you guys want me to talk about the order of the common life.
I'm not sure either. Let's just, just answer however you want.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think I'm going to start by this idea of an individual rule of life. In our order, we have a common rule of life, and then we have the way that each person lives that out. So a mom of young children is going to live out her commitment to Sabbath or solitude very differently than, say, you know, a 65-year-old retiree. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all, but the inner work, the motivations, the meaning behind the desire for those practices, particularly in community. So in your rule of life, you want to be a community of rest, a community of peace, a community of love. You're not in this for yourself. You're becoming part of something bigger than yourself. You're doing your own inner work for the good of the community that you're a part of. And you're doing that in a way that is, you know, you're accountable to the people in your community. You are encouraging them. You're being encouraged by them. I love hearing how each person lives out our shared commitments. I learned so much from the different ways that people are living each of those out. It's really helpful in my spiritual direction practice, because I might not be able to relate to how a young mom of four kids observes solitude, but I can hear about that from somebody else and then share that with one of my directees. So that sharing of a common way of life is, I think, one of the most valuable parts of the spiritual journey. Like, we were never meant to do this alone. It is so important for us to be able to love and encourage and support one another in this.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And I completely agree.
Yeah. So we've talked a little bit, maybe as like a last question, we've talked about, or you've mentioned some of these before as I'm like tracking with what you're saying. But I'm wondering if we could like wrap up by like maybe culminating on some of these, pointing them out specifically. When you meet with someone who's discerning whether or not to adopt not just a rule of life, but a shared rule of life, maybe for in your context, like the order, but for our context, the Bridgetown rule of life, when you're helping them discern whether or not to adopt a shared rule of life, what are you helping them to look for or pay attention to in that discernment process? Like what are some of the signposts along the way that help them or can help them determine that now might be actually the wrong time for them to join? Or alternatively, what signposts suggest that actually might be the right time for them to join? What is that discernment process like with them?
I think one of the things that I look for is a willingness to make space for these practices. If someone is just trying to add it on to an already busy life, I don't think it's going to be very effective. And until they are willing or able to make space to really authentically engage these practices, it might not be the right time. Sometimes when I'm meeting with a directee, it's really interesting how God has gone before them and has already begun to shape their life in a way that is starting to open things up. Especially when I'm about to lead somebody into the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius, if I hear that suddenly they have all this extra time in their schedule and they're not sure why, and they've been wondering what to do with it, I think, God has been preparing the ground. Let's go. Let's do this.
Wow.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's really interesting to think about how you're finding not necessarily like explicit meaning, but invitation in like you're finding the sacredness in the ordinary parts of our lives and the ordinary kind of rhythms of our life, where something like finding myself with extra time could be translated as, oh, I just have extra time. Or it could be like, hey, I wonder what the Spirit's inviting me into. And I think maybe even staying present to that question, like, is the Spirit inviting me with this extra time into this thing? Or, you know, alternatively, and I think this is something we may have to be perhaps more aware of as a kind of a culture kind of in the West of hyper productivity, kind of hyper efficiency, some of the stuff you were thinking, like we could just as easily go like, can I add this into my life? Yeah, probably. Okay, let's go. And like that actually might be malforming to us. So it's sort of what is, you know, one of the things that you and I've talked about is like the goal of discernment is not to hear a yes, it's to get an answer. And a no is actually a successful discernment. And so I think we've got a really fun task ahead of us to reshape and reorient our own selves to what this kind of discernment process looks like. So I love that what you're saying is it's not like a, you know, angels coming through the ceiling, hyper spiritual experience as much as it is attending to your life. What's the Cistercian thing? Conversatio morum. Is that what it is?
Yes. Conversatio morum, the conversion of life.
Yeah. Say more about that. What is that? Why is that important in all this?
Oh, now you're speaking my love language. the Benedictine or Cistercian vows of conversatio morum, obedience to the Holy Spirit and stability within our commitments. Those are our common vows also in the order of the common life. And they all go together. So I don't like to just talk about one.
Okay.
Conversatio morum, a good way to think of this is just a commitment to allow God to constantly be tilling up the soil of our hearts, bringing things to the surface that need to be healed or reoriented. The vows of obedience to respond to that work that God is doing in us. You know, there can be resistance, but ultimately a yielding that's important. And then stability to stay in it long enough for that inner work to happen. I've had these vows actually, because I was a Benedictine oblate first. So I've had these lifelong vows since 2015. Mm. And I am always grateful for the way that they work in my life, but particularly that vow of stability. Because let me tell you, there are so many times I would have quit something or given up on something before I allowed God to use it to do an inner work in me. Mm. And so that is actually my favorite of the vows.
Mm. I love that. And I just love that the whole point of that is like my ordinary life becomes the means by which the Spirit encounters me. It's not some holy moment in prayer. It can be, but like oftentimes there's this commitment to believing that it's just the normal parts of my day and my life and my experience and the way that I'm wired, that God comes and meets me in, which is, I think, sometimes why we can miss God's voice in these spaces, is that we feel really convinced that he's not talking to me because I'm not having one of these, you know, wild spiritual encounters. But oftentimes he's speaking to us in a way that sounds much like our own very selves, that it feels like we've probably just made it up. And that could not be the Lord.
Yeah, actually, I would love to go back and talk about desire a little bit, which we touched on very briefly before.
Yeah.
You mentioned that particularly in the Protestant church, that we have a tendency to ignore our desires, discount them, or assume that they're all bad. Mm-hmm. And especially working with so many people in recovery from addiction, this is a huge hurdle that I have to help people over. It was a huge hurdle for me. Mm. I'm in recovery myself, and it was drilled into me. I'm an addict. I can't be trusted. Nothing that I want is good. All of my desires are pointed in the wrong direction. Mm. And certainly some of them were, but not all of them. And I think learning to trust that, you know, God is actually speaking to us in our desires is vital to this journey, and allowing those desires to be reoriented and reshaped. When I'm helping people learn discernment, you know, I just ask them, if you were to follow that desire to its logical conclusion, would it bring you closer to God or further away from God? That's probably the easiest way for a beginner to discern. And I think some of our desires, God is going to use to bring us closer to him, to lead us into some of these practices. You know, a desire to be more patient with your children is a good and holy desire. And that can lead you into practices of, you know, Sabbath and solitude and silence and generosity, a willingness to get interrupted over and over and over again, hospitality. So I have to help people learn to trust their desires and learn to discern where those desires would lead. But once you get really, really good at paying attention to those and discerning which ones are being stirred up by God and which ones are your flesh or, you know, your wounded patterns of relating, and you're able to sort through those, you can use that to navigate the spiritual journey and really find some deeply formational and rewarding spiritual practices.
Beautiful. I identify so much with what you're saying. And I think that this is such an important conversation because of the tendency to silo spiritual formation into a set of classic disciplines that, you know, in some dysfunctional, non-biblical understanding of God's affection and love, make God love me more, or either, you know, move me nearer to God, when of course the truth is that God is intimately involved in every aspect of my life. And, you know, you use the example of a desire to be more patient with your children. I'm a father of three between 2 and 7. And one of the primary ways that the Spirit is coming to me at the moment is through my children, both in the way that they delight in me in love as an expression of God's love and blessing toward me, and in the way that they challenge me and constantly draw up my sin in a way that God is inviting me to be shaped more into the image of Jesus. And so much of, you know, the work of Ignatian discernment or a rule of life or monastic formation or whatever terminology you gravitate toward is simply learning to notice the Spirit's invitations, making their appeal to you in your ordinary life. And then, like you're saying, Sister Heather, in some ways, like then finding a groove where, okay, if this is a theme that the Spirit's writing into my life, how do I not just notice that theme, but even lean into that theme through consistent practice or something like that? So I just hope that the people listening to this maybe will leave this conversation saying, I want to be more attentive to notice the places that the Spirit is coming to me. Because maybe there are just ordinary ways that God is making his appeal to me all the time that could, if noticed, become things I lean into and begin to delight more in God's presence to me in the life that he has given me to live.
It's beautiful. Yeah. Thank you so much, Sister Heather, for your time, for your wisdom, for the faithful life to Jesus that you have lived, that we get to kind of glean from. And thank you for the ways, and essentially to return to the beginning, that the spiritual practices open us up to the love of God. They're tools by which we notice God's voice, presence, and action in our life. And we discern that in community with faithful brothers and sisters who also want the same thing. And so thank you for adding your voice to this conversation. We are better because of it. So thank you so much. And we're really grateful that you were with us.
Thanks, Gavin. It's been my pleasure to be here.
Our hope is that as you've listened to our conversation, the Spirit was stirring a desire in you for some piece or part of what we've talked about. If that's you, we'd invite you to engage the Rule of Life through one of three invitations. First, consider taking a deeper dive into one of the practices by going through our Practicing the Way courses. Next, consider exploring and integrating various practices by joining a Bridgetown community. And lastly, if you have already cultivated most of the practices into your life, consider becoming a part of our covenant community, a group of people committed to the long, slow, formational journey of paying attention to how the Spirit uses these practices to form us. You can find more information on any of these invitations at bridgetown.church/ruleoflife.